talking with Ralph Nader, not just reading his Unsafe at Any's books series. He actually has a P.O. box. He does not release his home address. And if you seek to meet him, when I met him once, he insisted on just reconnoitering at a gas station and then walking to a nearby restaurant. And he looked over his shoulder the whole time. So I'm sorry, he's not here today either, that I know of. Okay, so welcome to episode 4, Internet and Society, Privacy. I titled this one, This Cool Optoelectronic Sling, only because it's an anagram for technologies, politics, and control. Don't worry that I've been wasting my time. There's actually a machine that will generate these things. And in some ways, that is a good summary of what we're going to talk about today. So I want first to provide a link from last week where we talked about encryption and how encryption flows quite nicely into this week's material on privacy. The first thing to realize is that we live in a layered network. One of the amazing innovations of TCP/IP protocol, the actual packets that sail around, is not only the fact that the packets can take different routes, so you can get half the message and not worry about the other half until later, and in fact the packets can be so tolerant of delay that they are now, the father of the Internet is now working on a protocol to communicate between here and Mars using TCP/IP, and the delays actually make it quite simple. And he has created the .mars top-level domain, which has yet to be entered into the network. I'm not making this up. This isn't meant to be a funny joke. It's actually true. So anyway, another of the innovations was that it's a layered network, one where at one level of operation, you need not worry about another one, either above you or below you. So TCP/IP works by not caring one whit whether the data that it's carrying is voice data or video data or your email or anything. It's just data is data, and it all fits into packets, a wonderful insight. And then one layer up, you can have programs like Eudora that don't need to know anything about TCP/IP. They don't care. They just push down to the application, here's what I want to send, now you figure out how to send it. And it's a wonderful layering process. We looked very much last week at several layers of that network, but all with the idea of encryption, how to take what would be meaningful text or data to somebody that just happened to encounter it and make it a big pile of garbage unless they've got the secret key that opens it up, thus enabling secrecy between the parties that happen to know the key, or in the case of key escrow, as we learned, the government that might have a backup key of sorts. In this case, you could see implementing encryption at the packet level. You could actually encrypt each packet, and there are people working on encrypted TCP/IP. Or even if the packets were perfectly readable, you could have them carrying data that had in turn been encrypted. And as a result, even with clean packets, as long as the data is encrypted, such as the original email, it also can't be read. We are going to go one level of abstraction even higher than a basic email and think more broadly about privacy in a network environment. And thinking of networks not just as the Internet as we know it, but the networks of friends, families, neighbors, employers, employees that comprise our daily lives and that are increasingly technologicized. And as I kind of suggested in the first week that we might want to do, it's worthwhile to reflect on who are the parties to this deal. Who are the people or entities whose privacy we are concerned with, and as against whom are we concerned about retaining their privacy? In the readings, you saw a debate between Singleton and Lessig. I think actually Lessig even at one point cited Singleton, not like a traffic citation, although almost, given how much they disagree with each other. Singleton taking the view, very traditional libertarian view, that says it's the government, stupid. Whatever the government's doing must, ipso facto, be terrible, and if it's private industry doing it, it's just fine. That's, of course, a rude caricature of her argument, but since you've all done the reading, you don't need me to do it justice. And Lessig's view that says that, wait a minute, in this new environment, the traditional ways of vindicating privacy, say the Fourth Amendment, even the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, these things all adhere against the government. We need new ways to think about privacy vis-a-vis the other parties that may be doing more than just the kind of neighborly gossip that sufficed for one kind of invasion of privacy in colonial times. So that's kind of the, is it the government we care about or private parties? And each has weighed in very differently on that question. And also the thought, when you think about who the parties are, when we talk about encryption, what we're most concerned with is a third party, somebody that wasn't invited to the to the conversation, listening in and making some hay out of it, whether that's your competitor, if you're in an industrial context that might listen in, or whether it's the government listening in to the deal that you're having going down, it's some third party that you didn't intend to hear it. It may be that part of the privacy debate here doesn't have to do with third parties, it has to do with second parties. People that you're talking to, but you tell them a secret and say, and by the way, don't tell anyone else. And they agree that they'll only tell their 20 closest friends, and then they do, and before you know it, you feel that your privacy has been invaded. Not because of somebody overhearing you, but because someone whom you trusted, in some sense, betrayed you. There's also a distinction that we saw coming out. I leave it to you to decide how useful a distinction it is between monitoring and searching. Monitoring somehow being an ongoing ability just to kind of tune into the world and see what's going on. As if you figure the Truman Show is a great example of monitoring. The guy's life was monitored from start to finish. Be a great example, perfect one if it weren't fictional, but it's fictional. Also searching. Searching, the idea being that thanks to the ability to keep records so cheaply and index them so thoroughly, even if somebody isn't monitoring you, as something happens, as long as it happens once, it is saved for all time, and somebody could go back later, they've created new verbs for this, to nexus someone. Probably one of the first things you did when you discovered you had free access to Nexus was to Nexus yourself, your family, your loved ones, and see if they'd ever been quoted in the Chattanooga Daily News or any major newspaper around the world. That's a new ability to search that may be quite distinct from just the general idea of knowing that everything you're doing in casino life, wonderful. David Sobel has arrived at the side door. Welcome. Glad to see you. Strap on a less than functioning microphone. You're discussing a PowerPoint presentation, which, yeah, you know most of the stuff anyway. Monitoring versus searching, two distinct modes of thinking about ways in which the technology is changing the baseline. And of course, Lessig's message, as you may have noticed, was technology changes the baseline, and then we have to decide, are we happy that it takes us wherever it happens to, or do we want to intervene and say, no, no, technology, back to where you were, and push it back to some former status quo, or do we want to have some kind of legislation that then accounts for the changed technological facts? It may now be easier to listen in on people, thanks to, say, cell phone technology that just makes more conversations overhearable by your nosy neighbors, but we'll just pass laws that say, if you do something with it, say, get to a congressman, you're in big trouble. Another theme to think of today, and that in some way will unavoidably be the topic of today, is what do we mean when we say privacy? It's a word that is almost as slippery as justice. We're all generally well disposed to it. When asked, is there such a thing as too much privacy, there was actually a fairly healthy split within the class. Some people saying no, others relating it to that which it may be in tension with, but defining it differently each way, and some of them even saying, well, if by privacy you mean a duck, then I'm in favor of it, but if you mean a cow, I'm not so sure. So aside from possible animals, here are things that privacy could mean. One is the power to keep secrets. In some ways, that might translate to, in the privacy literature such as it is, the idea of rights as against collection, people collecting data about you. Now, secrets is a tricky word here, because traditionally, by secrets, we mean things we really mean to keep secret. We take the letter, we fold it, we put it in the envelope, we put the envelope in the drawer, we lock the drawer, we put the drawer in the safe, we lock the safe, and that way it's clear we mean it to be a secret, and our privacy is invaded if somebody grabs it. A lot of what we read about for this week was another kind of power to keep secrets, which was, inevitably, as we walk about the world, we advertise facts about ourselves, and to worry that somehow those facts are being noticed seems both futile and, as a policy matter, not something to deal with. But in the cyber world, there are all sorts of ways in which you identify yourself that maybe aren't so obvious, that it's not just what you happen to type. If you made it all the way to the end of the readings, even through the optional section, you saw a couple things about the GUID, the Global User ID, that we all discovered, but Microsoft knew all along since they invented it, is a unique identifying number that goes into Microsoft Office documents, and it can be used to identify you, and then we even saw it used in multiple contexts, including tracking down the guy that introduced a terrible virus to the country, He did so through a Microsoft Office document, and thanks to his GUID, he was quickly found. There's also the sense of the power to keep partial secrets. And what's a secret in that sense? Not something that's just your own private thing, but you tell somebody and you hope they don't betray you. And in fact, not just hope, but you assert some right against betrayal. I'm telling you, doctor, this information, but I'm not giving it to you so you can turn around and be an unnamed source in your post and convey the condition of my health to them. So in some sense, privacy is being able to reliably designate who knows what about you, with whom you choose to share it, and then bind them to whatever deal they might agree with. There's also the sense of it as freedom from intrusion. Freedom from intrusion, which means if somebody comes into your house, looks for something, some secret about you, doesn't find it, apologizes and leaves, your privacy has still been invaded. No information transfer has happened in the world, and yet in some sense, your privacy was compromised because your house was searched, people saw stuff about you, or even if they didn't see anything, somehow your dignity was offended by the nature of the search. And indeed, there's a whole category of searches enabled by technology that are fairly unintrusive. You don't feel yourself risked when they happen. You don't feel your carpet ripped up, peered under, and then put back down slightly askew as people come into your house. Rather, it's just a very kind of passive search that happens. And figuring out whether such a search is an invasion of privacy or in constitutional parlance, a search at all, is a very good question. And finally, at least in the legal constitutional context, you'll recall privacy as freedom to make certain decisions unfettered. This comes to there are certain decisions you might make or things you think about that represent something that is at the core of your being, against which the state, at least, maybe others, since we don't know the parties to the deal, has no business intruding. And when they do, for the purpose perhaps of getting you to make a different decision than you might otherwise, it's unconstitutional as a violation of privacy principles. Thus, in Griswold v. Connecticut, we see contraception at issue, abortion at issue, on privacy grounds. And it's not privacy as against information they disclose, privacy as in the right to be let alone, stay away from me, don't regulate me. But even in that context, you see this interplay between is privacy something that follows you around, and of course in the classic Fourth Amendment context, you've been exposed to debates that have happened as to, all right, is it the glove compartment of the car that's sufficiently connected to you such that it would require a warrant to be searched versus the trunk versus the shotgun that is visible under the front seat? And does it follow you as you go? So when you're in a taxi, you don't have the right because a taxi is kind of a publicish conveyance. All sorts of questions that have to do with person and place. Even in the freedom to make certain decisions unfettered, you see some anchoring to place, that decisions about procreation are decisions made in the bedroom. And the bedroom, the right to be secure on your papers and effects in your house, in your castle, the bedroom is the heart of the castle, and you even see that a possible location component tying down the otherwise fairly wide open right to not be regulated, to have certain decisions without government intrusion. So that's another question to leave hanging. As we come up with some good case studies today of privacy and whether we think a given activity is an invasion of privacy, if it's as against someone's right, we have to say, all right, well, how would you protect privacy if that's what you were of a mind to do? One way to do it is to create privacy rights. You know, whenever you want to see something happen, you give somebody a right. That usually means a proscription on someone else's behavior as against them, and you create penalties for violations. So you tortify whatever it is you want to see vindicated in people's interests. In the sense, the way the government, the U.S. government, has been thinking about it lately, it's largely been in the sense of what rights you may have, or since the Federal Trade Commission has been leading the charge here, what rights consumers may have in the commercial context. And one such right is just disclosure to the consumer of the way in which facts may be gathered about them. So it's not actually making a normative decision about what kinds of facts are and aren't allowed to be collected from them in this area, but just saying, tell them before you do. Give them information, and putatively, I suppose, they could go away. They don't have to use a given website, so when they read the privacy policy, they examine the fine print, and they decide, gee, you know, I just don't want my IP address being released for these purposes, they could go to another site that has an identical privacy policy. The other issue is inalienability. When you have rights, they're much more readily described as something that maybe you can't even waive because of imbalances you might have seen described by Shapiro. There are reasons why we don't want people to be able to sell them or convey them or repudiate them. And in that sense, no matter how much disclosure you give to them, they're still not really empowered to consent to giving out certain information or having it used in certain ways. That's one of the features of rights-defying privacy, is being able to further specify as the policy person, the legal person, do you want these rights to be inalienable. A wholly different way of creating a difference in the balance of power of information disclosure or general dignity intrusion would be through property interests. We want to enable a market so that people can then traffic in their, say, personal data or in their level of intrusion in their life. Some people like to live in glass houses. Some people want to be on the real world or go out onto Oprah. And when they do, they can say, I have a property interest here. You, Oprah, are not allowed to tell my story unless you pay me X amount of money. And then when you do, you may freely tell it, or you may film me for the next duration of this particular witch project, and when it's over, all rights in the resulting video revert to whomever may have originally signed the contract. And indeed, when people are so readily exercised about privacy, you can really, if you phrase it right, get people up in arms about invasions of privacy. It's the very same people that will wander the Star Market and truly, for 5 cents off a roll of toilet paper, will happily disclose the details of every single purchase they make to the grocery store without reading the policy that might say under what circumstances the grocery store would connect that information up with you or further distribute it. And finally, you could code it. You could not worry about creating legal property or legal rights regimes, but instead just say, we'll construct the technology to either make it easier or harder to collect data. We could order Microsoft, for example, to eliminate the global user ID from their documents. We could order Intel to get rid of the serial number that they have put into the Pentium 3 chip. David can speak a little bit to attempts to order them to do so when one isn't the government, just somebody well-meaning in the area of privacy trying to persuade them otherwise. And also software that helps negotiate over use, that can create a de facto property regime. That's P3P, the Platform for Privacy Preferences, which we can talk about and perhaps devise anagrams for at some point later in this session. And finally, you can see another example of the code responding to the ability to collect, store, and then use data in the idea of watermarking. Watermarking is the ability to take some data you have and label it in some clear way so that if I were to give you some information about me, I can label it so that if you then pass it on to someone else and I see it later on, I have now the pedigree for it and know that it's you who gave it away. And this could be quite important because as well-meaning as the Federal Trade Commission may be, if indeed you think that not only are they well-meaning, but their policies, such as they are good ones in the realm of consumer protection for privacy, as well-meaning as they may be, how do you take a privacy policy in which the site says, and by the way, we will never give your information out. When you go to Radio Shack and you tell us how old you are and your dog's name just to buy a AA battery, we're only doing that so that we can send you a catalog and the dog at some point in the future. If that, in fact, happens, how do you know that they're just not either lying or that they just changed their minds? Yeah, that was then, this is now, and we have a new president and a new policy. You could watermark your data, and some of you may have actually been clever enough to do this by creating different middle names for yourselves so that when you sign up to one list with an inadvertent or advertent misspelling, you can then see the way it goes. That's a very crude form of watermarking. You can imagine other technologies that would quite nicely tell you if, in fact, at least in certain contexts, people have been keeping to the bargains they promised you. So, all right, that leads us then around to the big picture question, soon to be attacked in the realm of case studies. All right, what is privacy? And what is privacy in the net context in the absence of physical boundaries that so often had been used to say, when you're in your own house, damn it, nobody has the right to know what color hat you wear, but when you're out wandering about in the world, it's fair game. And in the presence of an environment that has what I call ubiquitous sensors and cheap storage. I don't know if I mentioned this the first time through, but we've seen kind of two eras so far in the technologicization of information. And I'm not going to talk about books and Gutenberg. That's a different two eras speech that I don't give. By two eras, I mean first an era of cheap processors. Computing power just got terrifically cheap. And as soon as it got cheap, it meant there were increasing numbers of situations where it made sense to deploy it. And thus did Teddy Ruxpin, a talking animated bear, end up with more computing power in its tummy than an aircraft carrier in 1956 used to steer itself along, or that Mr. Coffee, in fact, is a better computational machine than the Apple II GS. You end up seeing computers deployed in all sorts of instances and able then to start influencing more and more areas of our lives. I would take the, I forget the name of it, what was the name of the Japanese toy? It was a pet egg. Yeah, the Yamaguchi? All right, I don't know how many people have enjoyed partaking of this toy. It's a great example of incredible computing power put under the hood of a small egg-like object solely for entertainment that, at least for a brief period of time, had wonderful social implications. So it taught kids the benefit of cheap pets that after when you got bored of them, you didn't have to bury them. Aside from cheap processing, that was sort of the 70s and early 80s. The late 80s and early 90s introduced us to a second era, the era of cheap networks. Cheap networks meaning that, wow, I can just wire from here to there to everywhere, and it doesn't actually matter where the data is because in a heartbeat I can ship it to wherever it needs to be. And thus, in a later session, we will learn about the open versus closed proprietary software versus non-proprietary software debate, and indeed the debates that swing like a pendulum. I'm reminded, actually, of consulting agencies that always, you know, like management consultants, they come in, and if everything is too decentralized, they say you clearly need to centralize this, and if it's centralized, they say you clearly need to decentralize. Similarly, computing has gone through such pendulum swings. In the early days, there was one mama ship, and then we had dumb terminals that all plugged into them over a network. Then we got the idea, wow, computing is cheap. Let's just have everybody able to compute, and you don't need to actually tune into the mothership. And we are now entering a third sub-era there where we say, wow, why don't we put all the data in one place and use cheap networks to have light clients, dumb computers, tune into them, which may well be a good idea, whose days are already numbered. But again, you see a sort of pattern that is enabled and put up a quantum by the prevalence of cheap networks. And the ability to ship data around instantly means that we can plug into Lexis anytime we want, wherever we want, and look up the license number of the person who just cut us off in front of us, and then immediately send them an angry email saying that we should take it to the next exit. The third area, in addition to cheap networks, and it's the one that we're just entering, so it hasn't yet really entered the common lexicon, is the era of cheap sensors. Cheap sensors being cameras that aren't hundreds of dollars anymore to have a little black and white thing on top of your computer, say, and you wave to it, and then something highly pixelated that looks like maybe a large blob over here moving around is seen by someone on the other side with the fast processor and the fast network. There's now the opportunity, thanks to the enhancements in sensing technology, to imagine all sorts of ways in which these can be deployed in our daily lives. And you might ask, what is the Mr. Coffee of cheap sensors? And to me, one possible answer could be, for example, being willing to take place in a community experiment whereby everybody or a lot of people in the city of Cambridge, either for a fee or a reduction in their taxes or for fun, agrees to wear some biometric identifiers. How fast are you breathing? How fast is your heart going? And then, what fun, you can tune into the net and get a map of Cambridge as to where the action is. Where do people appear to be cheering? Where are they excited? Where are they bored? Who's asleep? Who's not? And as sort of just fanciful as that may seem, you can imagine obvious applications in traffic control. Give every car a transponder, and immediately you don't have to rely on smart travelers' camera atop the Bay Bank Center to tell you that there's a traffic jam in Boston. Of course, you don't need anybody to tell you there's a traffic jam in Boston. There's a traffic jam in Boston. But even apart from that, you could gather data directly from individual cars or people and have a sense as to the breathe in and breathe out of the populace. There are all sorts of ways in which cheap sensors are transforming how things are going. Again, we're only seeing just the first few drops of the first wave of it on the net, including GenniCam. I don't know, how many people have tuned into GenniCam? How many people have tuned into GenniCam and just didn't want to say so? All right, one, two. There's a woman named Jenny who, in her dorm room, which had a cheap network and a cheap processor, she got a not-so-cheap but still got it camera and just left it on all the time. And let people tune in to watch Jenny. It's called JennyCam.com. It has since reverted into one of the most popular pay sites on the net. She's since graduated college and taken up business. Her business is being her in front of a camera and charging for it. So you can see that, and that's somewhat, you know, Oprah-esque in offering herself up as a subject of entertainment. But there are all sorts of ways in which cheap cameras are working their ways all around the world, on street corners, over intersections, etc. And again, asking what privacy is with this huge technological change is a good question. So that's sort of how I wanted to frame the discussion so far. And I think maybe it would be useful to introduce you, David, and let you just say a couple words about what is keeping you up awake most at night on the issue of privacy. David Sobel from the Electronic Privacy Information Center, somebody who thinks about this stuff all the time, even at night before he goes to sleep.
Well, actually, John, you always give me ideas about what should keep me up at night, so I think tonight I'll be thinking about these biosensors. In fact, I think it's very hard to project ahead and anticipate what it's going to be. So we try to focus more on the collection techniques that exist today and think about what are the future uses that could be put to the information that's being collected today. Because a lot of this debate, as you might know, is centering right now over the question of whether or not so-called industry self-regulation is adequate, or whether there is in fact a need for legislative or regulatory approaches that would set some basic ground rules, particularly on the internet, with respect to the collection of personal information. The reason why we worry a lot about the future uses of information is that it raises the question as to whether or not there is really such a thing as informed consent, because that's really what motivates a lot of the proposals for self-regulation, the idea that a website just needs to post a privacy policy and the user is then aware of the fact of what is being collected, how it's being collected, and what the current uses of the information might be. Setting aside for a minute the question of whether anybody can really ever understand one of these privacy policies, let's assume for a minute that you can and you have a good sense of what's being collected and what the ground rules are, you will almost always get to the last clause of one of these privacy policies, which will typically say the website reserves the right to change this policy. And if we do that, we'll give you notice. Presumably, if you look back in 6 months at the privacy policy, you will notice that it's changed since you saw it last, and that's what they describe as providing you with notice. But in any event, the problem is that you might sign off on the current understanding and say, okay, under this framework, you can collect this information, but given the rapid development in business models on the internet, it's really impossible to say how this information is going to be used a year from now, 5 years from now. The example that I like to give is actually a non-internet example and has to do with the supermarket discount cards. And there seem to be very few public concerns about the use of these cards. People generally say, well, I don't mind if the supermarket has a list of the products I buy. I really don't have anything to hide. As I understand it, all they're using this information for is to target coupons to me and basically better enable them to target their advertising to me as an individual consumer. And then when you ask people the question of how they would feel if somewhere down the line the supermarket realized that they have a database that might be of interest to an insurance company, and the fact that they buy whole milk and butter and bacon at some point in the future could be used as a basis for denying them health insurance or life insurance, suddenly you see this look of terror come across their face. They say, I really haven't thought about that. So, I'm just thinking about this in terms of junk mail and whether or not I want to get coupons for bacon. So the problem is that there's not always a clear-headed consideration of what could be done with
the data. Would the insurance company have the right to ask and make it a material breach of the contract were in your answer you to lie? How much bacon do you eat? Before we insure you, we just have a few questions for you. Question number one, what's your weekly intake of bacon?
So you're asking if in their direct relationship with the insurance company, they ask you that question without telling you that they are then going to cross-check that against the database that they bought from Safeway?
Well, first they're just asking. You have freedom to lie, I suppose.
Well, I would say that they would, in that scenario, have a basis for revoking a policy if they could later demonstrate that you had misrepresented what they considered to be material information.
And is it offending a privacy interest that you should have to answer such a question in order to get your insurance?
I wouldn't think so. I think that's a one-on-one transaction, and you're in that instance free to decide, I don't want to answer this question, I guess. That's going to be the end of my application.
So
that's always the case.
Is it then boiling down to a fair warning issue that you wouldn't have been getting the bacon or you would have been shopping elsewhere if you knew that the supermarket was in cahoots with the insurance company and would alert them to your greasy habits?
I think it frequently does come down to a question of notice. But the problem is, as I say, it's an issue of prospective notice when maybe the website or Safeway cannot today honestly tell you what is going to become of this information in 5 years. So it's a question of controlling the information once it has been put in the hand of another party and having a way of tracking and continuing to control the dissemination of that information in the future.
So if there were best practices that you might care to help devise for companies that gather data and they're doing business and then maybe even are seeking to do ancillary business trafficking in that data, you might say one thing is don't make retroactive changes without consent of the parties involved.
Correct.
That would alter what would happen to their data. So that's sort of a due process kind of procedural thing.
It really is. I mean, what we generally point to are the so-called fair information practices, which is at the federal level, and really at this point I think in most states, are codified in the Privacy Act. The interesting situation that we have right now is that when you look at governmental collection and use of information, pretty much across the board, that's a problem that has largely been solved through the enactment of legislation like the Federal Privacy Act, which provides for fair information practices, which basically give the individual the right to notice of what's being collected, notice of how it's going to be used, the ability to actually review information that is maintained under the individual's name, and sometimes, as in the Federal Privacy Act, the right to request the expungement or correction of inaccurate information. So there's a problem.
The honey bacon, not the...
Well, that's right. Or, I'm just buying 1 pound a week, not 5 pounds. But the problem now that we're confronting is what's going on in the private sector. I think the advances in information technology have really moved most of the privacy problem now into the private sector. And there's sort of an interesting circular phenomenon that's also occurring, which is that the federal government, which is itself restricted in its ability to collect information in the first instance, is increasingly becoming a consumer of information collected by the private sector. So it's a question of sort of extending the principles that we enacted to apply to government in the wake of Watergate in the 70s to the private sector.
So just to push this a little bit further, aside from procedural boundaries on the behavior of private sector entities with respect to the information they collect and the people they collect it from, and whether those boundaries could be established by normative pressure or by actual law on the subject, by actions by the Federal Trade Commission, are there substantive boundaries you would put across? Again, let's stick with the Star Market example, whether it's Star Market for which you are ordering stuff online, such as whenever people use Peapod or Home Run delivery service. And when you do that, obviously, whether you have the Advantage card or not, you're telling them what you want and where you live so it can be delivered. Or when you just walk in the Star Market and use your card, is there any substantive limit? Is there any contract you would not allow to be signed between the purchaser and the seller in that instance? If the contract clearly said, here's the deal, and we promise not to change it without your consent, but the deal is, we reserve the right to sell this information about what you buy and when to whomever cares to buy it. And in fact, through that, we offer you lower prices because we can be more competitive, and it's a competitive business, the grocery market. Is there any substantive limit you put on that contract?
I think if I could be convinced that there really was informed consent, this was not a buried screen that might or might not flash by the user, and that there was a real understanding of what the terms of the arrangement are.
So imagine
I probably wouldn't have as much problem as I have with this, what seems to be the practice today.
So imagine we had that deal, and all of you, before you walk into Star, a privacy counselor takes you aside, says, I understand you only want a quart of milk and a stick of butter and a pound of bacon, but before we allow you to buy that, we've got to sit down, here's a little carol, we're going to discuss Star Market's relationship to you in terms of privacy, and here's the deal, and then gives the deal as I just stated it to David. How many people would then, I mean, assuming you're not then so freaked out you would run out of the supermarket, but indulging that aspect of the hypothetical, how many people would then happily go buy the bread and milk and bacon, and how many people would say, I reject this, I can't agree to it, I'm going to the White Hen Pantry? So how many people would accept the deal? How many people would storm out and head elsewhere? All right, so we have consensus. We have a majority that would accept the deal. The rest would storm elsewhere. Yes?
Do they actually have options?
That's a good point. Annika says, well, maybe they could just structure it so it's not take it or leave it, but which would you like? You could actually see this even with television. Would you like free television with commercials, or exactly the same programs, no commercials, and $20 a month on your bill? Or would you like to see come in and you shop and you get this discount? That's actually how it works right now with the Advantage card, which I have an Advantage card. I've put it in the name of my neighbor's cat. I'm not sure if I've done something wrong.
I don't know if this is a good sample audience. I mean, asking students these questions probably isn't reflective of the public at large.
I love it. He surprised the audience after he loses them.
Well, I mean, students historically sell blood. I mean, they engage in medical experiments for $10. I mean,
so we need to be in loco parentis of this crowd, but the rest of the public, the rest of the beer-swilling, bacon-eating public would know better than to go into some market under those terms.
Well, but there was a sizable number who said no, they wouldn't take the deal. And I'm not suggesting that there's never going to be an audience for these arrangements, even when they're clearly spelled out. I mean, there's, you know, now the phenomenon of free PCs, if you'll basically sign your privacy rights away for everything you do with that computer, and, you know, people are on waiting lists to get the free machines. So I don't suggest that there is nobody who will accept these arrangements.
And then you accept the idea that such rights as they are generally, it's okay to have them as alienable, ones that the majority of the class that was happy to sign them away should be able to sign away, get their discounts, and proceed with those facts about them known. That doesn't trouble you in a policy.
No, I mean, you know, then there's another hypothetical that I frequently ask people, which is, if you knew that going into a physical shopping mall, there was going to be somebody surreptitiously following you around and taking notes on every window that you looked into, and every door you went into, and every item you picked up, would you still go to that mall if you knew there was another one where that wouldn't happen? And most people say, well, of course I wouldn't want that kind of monitoring. I mean, it's one thing when I go into a store and make a decision and I give them a credit card, okay, they know that I made this purchase. But in fact, that's the capability that the internet now provides in the shopping context.
To tie individual purchases together into a meta portfolio.
Well, it's this very detailed behavioral profile of how you come to the decision that you arrive at. And most people don't really think about that. So, you know, I think if there was a better understanding of the technology and the collection activities that are becoming more prominent on the internet, that people would think twice about it. Not everybody, but a lot of people would.
So to be sure, we've so far only looked at one particular hypothetical within one general category of that huge swath of privacy that we started with today. And while the star market kind of data collected while you are shopping may not be the best example, although it is among the most common and the one that certainly efforts about privacy, when you think about privacy as a general category where there's activity going on in the legal and policy arena, largely focus on this, either buying or shopping as the areas in which your privacy might be compromised. There are indeed other areas as well. And I thought there was one comment there. Why don't we take it and then shift to another area? Go ahead.
I just wonder what the fear is
Address that specific situation. You probably remember a year and a half ago or so, people were very concerned when Kenneth Starr subpoenaed the bookstore purchase records of Monica Lewinsky. And a lot of people said, wow, I never realized that when I buy something in a bookstore, the records are sitting there for some government agency to come in and subpoena. And I think it is the case that a lot of people were very concerned when they realized that. Suppose she had made the purchase at Amazon, and now we're talking about the scenario that I just presented, which is not only would records exist of what she actually bought, but everything that she had looked at before she actually made the purchase. And I believe that most people would be even more concerned if that had been the scenario, if Monica Lewinsky's Amazon browsing records for the preceding 6 months have been subpoenaed.
But shouldn't we tease apart there whatever feelings we may have about the level of frivolity there was to Ken Starr's investigation of Monica Lewinsky? I mean, change the title and suddenly it's the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of California wanting to know the online book purchases and browses of Ted Kaczynski. And sure enough, it reveals that 8 Ways to Build a Bomb was the most browsed book by this guy. Would that be data for which, for that use, you would regret that it was available and available through process of subpoena to be collected?
Yes, I would. And you know, I think this sort of moves us into another aspect of this issue, which is the balance that we want to strike between so-called law enforcement and public safety access to information and privacy interests. And I mean, this comes up all the time. I mean, this, of course, is at the heart of the encryption debate. And you know, these arguments are made all the time. Law enforcement always comes forward and cites the example of the way that they made use of information in a situation where most of us would say, yeah, that was a good thing. But if it comes at the expense of, you know, a huge database being developed that indicates all of our reading preferences, that's the situation where, you know, you have to make a societal judgment. Does the good use outweigh the bad use? And, you know, my sense from observing the reaction that a lot of the recent privacy issues have gotten is that most people tend to fall down on the side of more privacy, even if it means that law enforcement might have less access to information. You know, I mean, getting back to the Lewinsky case, Kramer Books in Washington, which was one of the targets of the subpoena, basically had to change their position in that situation, because initially they were prepared to cough over the records, and it was because of the protest that they heard from their other customers that they decided to take a more resistant approach to that situation.
I should give our student the last word on this issue. Go ahead.
It just seems like if you're an average law-abiding citizen, you're not possibly going to be not so convinced that the good does outweigh the bad. In other words, the marketing gave the opportunity to these companies to, or Amazon.com, to tell me, oh, here's a book you might be interested in based on my past purchases. To me, that outweighs bad. You know, I'm not planning on bombing, sending letter bombs to people afraid of the law.
This is the old refrain of, if you've got nothing to hide, what are you worried about?
Well, what if, you know, one of the problems in talking about these issues is that we all tend to take a snapshot of the current political environment. But, you know, what if we were in the Nixon administration and these records were being accessed by the IRS and they decided based on your reading list, you might have communist sympathies, and they decided that you know, they were going to take a closer look at what your sources of income were, and you know, that is a hypothetical that has a historical basis.
That's Ken Starrism. That's an example of a prosecution that any instrument that adds to its power is one we regret, because it's a malformed prosecution to begin with. Now, you're right. You may have to prepare, when you think about privacy, for the worst cases rather than the best ones.
Well, yes, we do, because a lot of what we're talking about here is building an architecture that cannot so easily in the future be turned on or off. To veer in another direction just for a minute, there is an ongoing debate as to whether or not the FBI should have the ability to dictate the design of the telephone system to better facilitate wiretapping.
Yes, we heard about this last week.
Okay. Now, a lot of people will say, well, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I don't have any problem with my telephone system being easier for the FBI to wiretap, because I'm not going to be involved in the wiretapping.
Okay.
And our response to that is, would you want J. Edgar Hoover to have had access to such a system? Don't only talk about the current political environment and the feeling that, you know, the legal controls are being complied with, and we really don't have concerns about abuses of the power. We're building a system that's going to be with us probably for the next 100 years, and none of us, again, talking about unintended consequences down the line, can predict what the environment's going to be. So you need to think ahead as to whether or not the capabilities that are being developed today might be subject to abuse in the future.
So let me ask, and Jonathan Sachs, our scribe of the day, has identified you only as student. Given your positions, I'm sure you wouldn't at all mind giving your name.
Mike,
did you say? All right, now you're thoroughly identified. So Mike, let me just ask you a question back real quick. Hypothetical one, government half of a law that says all cars produced after 1999 shall have within them a transponder and cheap sensor and cheap network up to a 1-foot satellite that will alert the relevant authorities anytime the car is driven above what the transponder on the speed limit sign says the speed limit is for the road on which the car drives. And we'll put a little bit of give in if it's more than 5 miles an hour above that speed limit. And then a ticket can be automatically processed and sent to the address of the person who owns the car. And if it happens enough, we will take that monster off the road. How does that fit with you?
Well, since I speed, I don't like it.
So you're a criminal, you're saying? Do you speed because you think the speed limit's just wrong, or?
I guess I speed because it's sort of a
So we can make the cost much higher, and then you'd stop speeding. You wouldn't be caught by this because you'd just slow down, right? So do you like it?
But I guess I just don't believe
that. Is privacy the right box into which to put your worry about it? Is your worry a privacy worry, or is it some other kind of worry?
It's just the worry of no longer being able to
loss of freedom.
How would you feel about your professor having access to your cable television records so that, let's say you did poorly on a final exam and you went and talked to him and said, you know, I was studying constantly for that exam, and I just don't know why I did as poorly as I did. And he could actually check and say, well, in fact, you were watching television nonstop for the week preceding the exam.
The PBS.
No, you would know if it was or wasn't.
Yeah, yeah.
You would know exactly what he was watching.
And then, of course, I also wouldn't like that, but I just got some
well argued, well argued. Put that guy down.
Well, Harvard's a private institution. Why couldn't it enter into an arrangement with your cable provider to buy those records? We're not even talking about the government in that situation. This is purely free market.
How do you differentiate
If you came out and Star Market was selling your login data to insurance companies, I think a lot of people would no longer shop there, so therefore I don't think Star Market would ever do that just because of the market mechanism. It would be a horrible business decision to do that. And with the media, something like that would be immediately publicized, it would be a huge outrage, and it just would never happen. If I can follow up on what Mike said, I think the reason the example is if any Harvard professor put that much interest in it,
you're mad you couldn't say that in the chat room this week, so you actually dared to say it aloud.
But this would all be automated. I mean, it would be trivial to do this.
Well, I think it brings up a serious point, which is that I think most people think that they need boring enough lives that they, when there is so much information generated per person, even with automated searches, that most of the theory is that boring enough lives
the safety of anonymity.
The radar of anyone who's going to be I think most private things people do on their internet will be a porno site, but it kind of doesn't do that. So I don't see us letting the same
I'm the same thing as our parents. I mean, they still have the degree about
well, she's warning you that these students may never grow up. But in fact, it's just the fogies that worry about.
Oh, no, I mean that's a good point, and that's important for me to hear. That I actually I'm going to think about that a little.
Yeah, Chris.
Even if they are
I think that's a very good point, and that's, you know, ask the question, you know, let alone, set aside the question of disclosures to third parties. I mean, just kept in-house by the entity that collects the information, what are the concerns? And I think manipulation of the relationship is definitely one of them. And, you know, the companies that collect all this information talk about wanting the ability to customize the experience for you and make opportunities available to you that you might be interested in, and sort of couch it in terms of improving your experience. But I do have real questions about that. I think it is much more of a manipulative process, as you suggest, than one that is designed to benefit you as the consumer.
So. Last comment on this point before we go on. Go ahead.
I just want to go back to your community network. I mean, it's not really about for me, that's the opposite of thought. It's a lot about the benefits of the community. They surprise you that you can sort of imagine like the situation that you support only, but maybe it's not 5 miles an hour over the 20. Anytime it's 1 mile an hour over, you get a huge ticket automatically, right? And so you can notice.
You'd have to pay for highways.
Or imagine even another situation, right, where the device actually slows your car down. It doesn't allow you to do that. And what that would do is it would actually make the road much safer for all of us. Right? So the benefit to me, right, is somebody who doesn't
Now, that's, to be sure, a policy balance that would have to be struck, and different people would strike it in different ways. Part of the way in which we might choose to strike it, thinking normatively about it, is just what we're used to. That brings the generational question back in. And the thought of that if the technological change, however quick we deem it to be, if it's sufficiently incremental, we can end up in a place that we would never have instantly agreed to end up at, but that piece by piece, we just found ourselves there and the republic still stands. And indeed, in Arlington, Virginia, they put television cameras over certain intersections that had red lights and stop signs. And what it revealed, that, you know, school buses run stop signs, dump trucks go plowing through stop signs, stuff that you don't see very often, but it happens. I guess it happens less often when there aren't other people around to see it. The camera saw it, and the first reaction from the community was outrage. How dare you invade our ability, or either our privacy, or our ability to run a stop sign if we feel like it. Ultimately, after the outrage, cameras went away, the cameras are now back. It's actually a very popular program in Arlington now to have these cameras above intersections. And indeed, I'm convinced every year the Mass Turnpike, you don't need these transponders and peat networks, you just need to divide, do average speed. Timestamp in, timestamp out, distance between exits equals average speed. And then there's actually a market in tickets, right? People go to rest stops and sell their tickets to others who are in a hurry. Yeah, you get around that at some point, too.
I just want to sort of bring us back to a basic principle that works here, which is, you know, there's sort of this majoritarian or communitarian sense that, well, if we're just talking about a negative impact on a small number of people, most of whom are doing something wrong, why do we have to worry about this? So are you going to say the same thing about the Fourth Amendment, for instance? Or what about the First Amendment? I mean, the basis of our constitutional system is that in order to protect minority rights, even sometimes at the expense of the interests of the majority, we have decided that there are certain basic rights that people ought to have.
Now, I still feel that we're into the easy case here, because it's the government, it's law enforcement, and we're used to getting into a tug of war with the government as to how much give we want there realistically to be in laws. I mean, you might instinctively think that perfect enforcement of every law would be a good thing, and then you start thinking about speeding, and you worry a little bit. The Part B hypothetical to the speeding on the turnpike question would be, you rent a car, one of the conditions of the contract of renting the car is that you obey all posted speeds and signs, and indeed your supplemental liability insurance is waived if the transponder in the car reveals that you have gone X above the speed limit, or even one better, as someone who once made the mistake of renting a U-Haul truck, there is a governor on the accelerator. So you're sitting there on the Chicago Skyway with a stick shift 15-foot truck, and you're trying to speed up, and you can't. It actually, the pedal pushes back at you, you manage to jam it down, and nothing happens. The thing hovers at 55.0 miles per hour. Again, controlling through code what you might not through law, and code written not by the government, but by a company. Hey, it's their car, you don't like it, go rent from somebody else, and let the market decide, and have the epiphenomenal benefit, perhaps, of increasing public safety. So with that, I want to actually shift to another case study, and I'm sorry that not only did the bot manage to put everybody into a major fit of confusion today, it made the answers momentarily inaccessible to me. I was very curious, actually, to tally up some of the worst-case nightmare stories I had solicited from all of you, and generally to see how many had as an element of the story the commercial context. Something happens when you buy or shop, and then it gets used against you, and maybe even part of using it against you is it generates more ads or targeted marketing to induce you to buy or shop. I want to look at another relationship, and again, one that does not involve the state, and see how we feel about that. And for that purpose, I'd like to introduce Mr. James Gavell. James Gavell is the president and founder of Birch Tree Systems. Birch Tree Systems generated the advertisement that comprises page one of the readings for this week. And here, let me give you a microphone. There you are. So welcome. Please have a seat that isn't there. And I'd love to just start. I know you've got a demonstration for us of sorts, but I'd just love to hear the story of how you came to do what you do.
We were approached. Birch Tree Systems is a software company, and we were founded in 1997 to do utilities, much like the Norton utilities and those types of things. Our approach was to make computing easier. We were approached in the spring of 1997 by a fellow who said, you know, my kid comes home and he says he's going to go upstairs and do his homework on the internet. I'd like to see what he did. And we thought about that and very quickly came to the conclusion that that's Big Brother. And we don't want any part of that. Another partner in the firm was doing some work at a middle school computer lab up in New Hampshire. The lab administrator was talking about the students coming in and hacking around on the network, bringing it down. He made the comment, if only I could see what they had done. That was the comment that gave birth to the product that we call NetSee. We have written and we now distribute a software product that allows a designated individual to sit on a network and watch what's going on at all the other PCs on that network, pretty much in real time, not second for second, not keystroke for keystroke, but at a slight delay, we can watch what an individual is doing. And we can also record that. What Birch Tree Systems does, different from our competitors, is we do everything visually. We capture screens. We watch the screen going by, or we log the screen as a screenshot. Competitors, when the logging feature is turned on, record a textual record of what took place. We differentiate ourselves in that because I know none of you have been to porn sites, so this might be informative for you. www.whitehouse.com is not where the president lives.
Well, that we know of.
That's .org or .gov. So reviewing a log of where an employee had visited for websites. When we saw a White House, we tend to skip right over and say, well, it was okay, they visited the White House, but they shouldn't. Here, we're showing it visually, and we're time and date stamping it with the login of the user so that it's visual, it's irrefutable. You can't say it wasn't me or I wasn't looking at it because you've signed in and the data's been captured. And that, in a nutshell, is how the product came to be.
So the first thing you were asked to do, you felt that was Big Brother S.
Absolutely.
Tell me again how the second thing differs from the first.
The premise was that the network in the school, in the computer lab in the school, was being brought down. It was being damaged. I mean, middle school age, the kids were hacking and having fun, and it was great, but it was a nuisance to the lab administrator. So when he made the comment, if only I could see what they had done.
And then carrying that over into the corporate context, there is harm to the company whenever an employee is goofing off or...
Sure. There's a little bit of harm. When anybody's goofing off, yeah, there's a little bit of harm. The big harm, of course, is if you and I were visiting a pornographic website and a female employee went by and saw it and was offended by it. Now the company has a hostile environment lawsuit on their hands.
So interesting, it may be the effect of law, in this case sexual harassment law, you say, that, and the ad that we feature on the first page makes some reference to this. It speaks of legal liabilities that you may incur as a company if you don't have such software.
Correct.
And the legal liability, yes, you may open the door for damaging corporate legal liability. By that you mean contributing to the generation of a hostile work environment
by
not monitoring and then eliminating that kind of activity.
And it's our finding of late that the law, the law is finding for companies that have monitoring policies or monitoring devices in place and saying the company has done everything reasonable to prevent this, and finding the companies that do not have this in place are exposing themselves to some liability.
So do you have a demonstration of this?
We sure do. This is a canned demonstration that will simulate 8 computers.
Well, I wanted to install it on a computer in one of the offices here at Harvard, but it wasn't a good idea.
I understand Harvard has something like this. We password protect the product.
Now, this is what the administrator would see running the program
from
a room completely removed.
That's correct. I'm the nasty guy in the back room watching what's going on. And here we have 8 screens flashing by. I can size these. I can control it. I can look at one at a time. And size that. And also, I can be doing work. I don't have to sit here and watch what's going on all the time.
Is anybody watching you? Is it?
Oh, no. I'm the boss. email monitoring. So I'm loading a Word document here.
Now this, we had this strange monitoring versus searching and archive distinction. This does both. You can look at it in real time and take snapshots at regular intervals.
That's correct. Sorry, this isn't a Word document. It's something on email. But the point is, I can be doing other work and go back to my monitoring and see what's happening while I'm not watching. I'll go back to the multi-mode. And then I can go back to work. And then I can go back to what you're doing. close this for now. If I want to talk to this person, I've stopped the machine, and we see it's user 6 settings. That's just something you put in here. User logged in as Mike 22.
It's Mike.
He was speeding by this website. Scott logging is you. Sorry, it's disabled for the demo. I will show you a log file in a moment. But if I had went down and talked to Mike and said, look, you know, you're going on all these porn sites all the time and people are talking, stop it. And he doesn't, I start to log his activity. Another thing I can do is simply save a picture of this right now, time and date stamp it, and it's saved, and I can print it out later. Go back to auto. The logging, back in here, again, is all visual. Can't spell.
High security program.
You didn't see that. I can open this. What I see here is that at 5-minute intervals, we looked at user number 5 on September 14th. And this is what user number 5 was doing at 5-minute intervals at that date. Not very productive.
And does it keep these things around forever, or after a while, sort of like a security tape on a continuous loop that trashes the...
Forever, however long I want it there. I control how long it's there for. Here's somebody we logged at 2-minute intervals. This person is burning profits. And it's not moving any cars either, are they? What else are they
doing here? Now, is this actually for the purposes of demo, or this is a real user?
This is for demonstration purposes only. It's me. But somebody had to make the demo, so...
I think you want the clean over...
Yeah, we want the clean. Actually, I should say, in a serious note, we are about to come to market with a product specifically for the classroom, where from here I could take a control of the student's computer and I could either close the game out or, more importantly, I could move the jack down here.
We're talking about privacy, and I challenge 3 of you to chess while we do it.
And we can have a dialogue box with the student so that the student and teacher can interact quietly without disrupting the rest of the class, and it could be a tutorial take place, soon to be announced.
So let's just see first if there are questions just about how it works, fills it in, that kind of thing. Yes?
Yes, the manual that comes with the software has a sample acceptable use policy in the back, and it also references some websites that are available that contain other boilerplate acceptable use policies. We also provide a sticker for every computer in the network that says NetSee at work. We recommend that you tell the employees before you put it in. Don't just, this isn't about spying on people to see every mouse click. This, you know, tell the employees. We get called Big Brother all the time, and it's like we're spying on people. We're not really spying on people. We're trying to see how the asset's being used and see how the people are working all day. So we recommend strongly, we give you the stickers, put them on every computer that's being monitored, and tell the employees before you do it. Yeah.
Other questions just about how it works? Yes. Questions?
Well, I was just calling you a sense about how that actually plays out. Do you know if I'd love to see what people actually do in terms of things you
sell the software to you? Absolutely. We've also found, ourselves and some other companies have found that after putting the software in, the nonsense falls off by about 80% right away. And there's always going to be that certain few that are going to fit this clearance.
Do you sometimes just sell the stickers and not the program?
We've discussed that.
Yes.
What kind of assets do you have to have to install the network? I mean, you as a legitimate operator, a guy like yourself,
does it require client-side software, he wants to know.
It does require client-side.
But if I get asked, is there a way to remotely monitor it, happening on the network itself? Is it not access temporarily? If you saw a network, you had temporary access to the network and the client server, and then you were to monitor remotely another network, you would imbalance the software.
I can dial in. Yes, I can.
Other questions, just about how it works. Yes.
Are there any product systems that need it, like anti-NFC, or is it easy to sort of hack around it?
We haven't written that yet. No, I don't think.
Yes. Mike.
How does this work if you have like 500 employees, or actually any more than 10 employees?
We deploy it hierarchically, so that group leaders would watch their people, and supervisors watch group leaders, managers watch supervisors, and that type of thing. No one can reasonably watch, 25, 30 people.
So how's business?
Brisk. Business is good.
And do you guys have any other metrics? pretend I'm... you want me to invest in your company, you have an annual report. I don't know if you're privately held, publicly held.
We are private.
You're privately held, yeah. So you don't have to do annual reports. You actually are private.
That's
in
right.
Your data.
Yeah.
The business is brisk.
Yes.
And is the market competitive?
More than we wish it were, yeah. In fact, too many. Initially, there was only a half a dozen of us, and recently we found about 33 or 34 companies doing something similar.
Yeah, I noticed this thing from Wired News recently, a software utility that secretly records computer activity in alarming detail, counts some high-profile corporations and government agencies among its clients, but not a one wants to talk about how they're using Investigator to monitor. Have you heard of Investigator?
Yes.
The software produced by Win What Where performs some impressive monitoring of any and all user actions. It records the time, the date it started, how long it was active, the name of the program, title of the window, every keystroke that was entered, said Richard Eaton, president and founder of the Kennewick Washington Company. Better still, all of its activities are conducted in stealth mode. It's as quiet as can be on a computer. You won't see it on the task list, Eaton said. Originally designed to help system administrators track down software and network problems, Investigator has found an eager audience among corporate and government clients, including Delta Airlines, Exxon, Ernst Young, the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Mint in Denver. What do people do with the U.S. Mint all day? The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and Lockheed Martin. That sounds right to you? That's
and actually, yeah, in the beginning, you asked me the question and I looked at you, gave you the brisk answer. Nobody wants to own up to, going public with what they're doing.
Indeed, we actually tried to get a representative from one of your clients to come today and could not do so. Yes, other questions?
Are you aware that the system of software where home virus?
I see. They weren't features, they were bugs. And programs like this. And now they're features. Now indeed, and we've been talking a little bit today about levels. That's how we opened the PowerPoint slideshow. This is at a very high level of refinement. This is going by user screens, as you've explained, is highly visual. the software that I just described out of Wired isn't as visual. It's at a finer level of detail, less kind of big picture. But still, from my read of this, requires some form of client-side software, which means they have to get to your laptop, whether by virus or by having physical access to it, install the stuff, and away they go with it. There's, of course, built into the very network, the ability to sniff. In fact, there's a whole category of things called packet sniffers. And with them, anybody on the network, and in fact, anybody within a subnet of the network, that means all of you plugged in, can actually sniff. And indeed, Ben was somebody who once explained to me the idea of Ethernet cards, that they each have a unique identifier built in from the time it leaves the company. There's a John Postel-like figure, the Santa of sorts, who numbers Ethernet cards for a living and makes sure that 3Com's numbers don't conflict with Netgear's numbers. And that unique number is what ultimately allows the network to know one destination from another on the network. And the latest version of network protocol has as your IP address those serial numbers. Part of it is identifying what your overall serial number is. So anytime you're on the network and you are sending a packet, the packet says who it's from, particularly if it's expecting an answer of sorts back, the who it's from will then be pegged to the physical card in your computer that you're using. And you don't need client-side software for that. And indeed, there are cards that are called, as Ben explained to me, promiscuous Ethernet cards. Promiscuous Ethernet cards don't just listen to data that is addressed to them. They listen to all the data that goes by. And when they do, they obviously then have the ability to be sniffing about the network and seeing what goes on. But there's many of the activities here, solitaire would not involve network activity, so without the client-side software, you wouldn't know what was going on. Certainly surfing the pornographic sites, those are logs that could be kept by anybody on the network, and certainly hierarchically anybody upstream, including the internet service provider. So if you're on a cable modem, if you're on AOL, there is no technological barrier from them knowing exactly every destination you have asked for. Indeed, they have to know it in order to get you there. Did you have another comment, James?
No.
Okay. So first, it might be worthwhile to think about legal doctrine for a moment. Is there any law against this? Now, is one of your lawyers in the room?
I'm sorry?
Is one of your lawyers in the room by any chance?
Two.
Two of your lawyers are in the room. Hello, lawyers. So I'm a prospective client. This is called cold calling. I'm a prospective client of James's company, Birch Tree Systems. I'm looking to buy this. I've got a small mint that I'm running, and I want to make sure that my employees are doing what they ought at their respective terminals. So I'm just curious, is there any legal barrier to my doing this? Am I somehow opening myself up to liability for spying on them?
Well, I think as long as notice is given to the employee, then provide the employer to monitor the use of
so I could put that in the employee handbook or their original employment agreement. And so long as I've done that, I can gather the information, I could use it for whatever purpose, I could give it to anybody.
I think
that's
for the proper purposes.
I'm not convinced that notice is even required.
So tell us more.
Well, in the telephone monitoring and email monitoring cases that have arisen, the courts have basically said that there's no privacy interest on the part of the employee because this is the property of the employer, and the employee is just using this stuff and should do so with the knowledge that there should not be an expectation of privacy. So I'm not sure that there would even, at least under the electronic privacy, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, I'm not sure there would even be a requirement for prior notice.
So this is at least a cautious opinion. It couldn't hurt to give notice.
Oh,
you're saying it's not even clear. You have to.
I agree that as a matter of policy, it should be.
But from a legal doctrinal standpoint,
it's not clear that there would be liability on the part of an employer who did not provide notice.
Right. Now, has anybody ever come to the company saying, I've got a bunch of people who work from home? You know, the employees in the office, I can at least wander around, look over their cubicle and see what they're doing, so they tend to behave most of the time. But I've got a bunch of people telecommuting. And they're using their own computers and their own stuff, but can you also install this on that? So when they're working from home, you might see what they're doing.
We cannot do that at this time, but it's on the drawing board.
Version 3.
Version 3.
Gotcha. Do you see any legal difference there, given that spaces seem to have so much to do with
it? Well, I was going to say that I think the answer, you know, whether there are any legal impediments, does have something to do with the environment in which this is used. I think if you're talking about a home computer, and if there were some way to install this software in an employee's home computer without them knowing that it was there, that might start to run up
their again. Property interest.
The ECPA prohibitions on unauthorized interception.
Gotcha.
That's, you know, yes, now you're in the individual's home, you don't have the argument that this entire system is the property of the employer.
So then let me ask you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't know that I'd want to install it on an employee's personal home computer, but if it was a company notebook or something that they were using, then yeah, I don't think I'd have a problem with that.
Right.
But I don't want to do it in their personal computer.
Yeah, but even if
the market clamors for it.
If the scenario was an employee says, I've got a computer at home, I'd like to telecommute, and the employer hands them a disk and says, well, this is the software you need to connect to our network, and part of the package, unbeknownst to the employee, is the client side of this, then I think that would be an interesting issue.
And he's saying he wouldn't go there anyway because he wants to draw the boundary at literally the gates of the front gate of the company, the physical territory. So, yes.
I'm curious what happens in that situation if your computer and your trunk gate, you can take my GPA at night. I mean, where does the line cross from the trunk gate? They can monitor you during the day for the working hours, just going to work occasionally, say like at 8 o'clock at night, and just work remote.
At the office, you're saying?
No,
at home.
But you're working from your computer at home, and that's your job. And so when you off the clock.
Well, what James says so far is he wouldn't even go there. He wouldn't be there to begin with, right?
If you're telecommuting and you dialed into the office network, then you might be monitored. But if you're not dialed into the office network and you're surfing the web, then you're not going to be monitored.
No.
Right.
But the assumption is that once you use that network, whatever time it is, then you are subject to
monitoring. In this particular implementation, remember, we're limited only by our imaginations, pretty much, as to how we might code the different ways in which you could do this. You could only hire consultants that agree to allow to have their hours billed, just like a lawyer, in eighth-hour increments or what have you. And here's when they're on the clock, and here's when they're on, and you want to see what they were doing during the time you paid them to do it. Would that be so unreasonable?
John, I wanted to say another thing about liability, but it's a different kind of liability. It's not the question of liability for the monitoring, but I have often wondered when an employer takes such active measures to monitor the computer activities and the internet activities of their employees, whether or not they might not be opening themselves to liability to third parties when that employee, for instance, goes onto a Yahoo message board and posts a defamatory message during work hours. I think the defamation plaintiff in that case could then come to the employer and say, you claim to be controlling the use of your employee's internet activity, and I am now holding you jointly responsible with the employee who posted this material.
So this is a kind of can implies ought sort of thing. And
I think the more, from the perspective of third-party liability, I think the more enlightened position for a company is to take a hands-off approach and say, we don't monitor our employees' email activities. We don't monitor what they do on the internet. So if you, third party, have a problem with something that originated out of this organization, talk to the employee, because we have an explicit policy of not monitoring and not controlling.
You could call this the risky business policy, by which the employees are left to their own devices, and again, as you say, we have purposefully not availed ourselves of a way to monitor them, and therefore you can't trouble us.
Right. So I think this liability question is a two-way street.
Other thoughts? Yes. Samia.
You
it seems like you were talking that you don't want to be a big brother, you don't want to do the role, be in the role of a big brother. And I'm sorry, you're so inspired by companies, and what if you have the ability or the willingness to include the contract or the license agreement that allows you to say that you need to put the stickers on the network for a closer and being that you can then
I'm not a lawyer. I doubt we have that power. I mean, I can tell you with cars, they don't go over 65, but the idea is, warranty void if tab is removed here. Software will shut down if we discover that you haven't properly notified your employees. Or in fact, you could build into the software an alert, right? You could build into the client side of the software a big blinking eye or something that would indicate that at any time this may be monitored. Or you could even have it only appear when in fact on the supervisor's screen, your screen is being watched. Right? You could do that, I suppose. Has that been requested as a feature? No. I'm not surprised. But you're right. It's all, again, you can, there's a way. Your idea was do it through contract. You can also see doing it through the code.
That's
what you
want to do. The developer is the
Well, there is a distinction. A State Department has far more rights to listen in on their employees than private industry does. Certainly where classified information is involved, you've signed a whole bunch of contracts backed up by a whole bunch of law pertaining to access to certain kinds of government information and a whole surveillance regime designed to keep you honest with it. But, yes. And would you say it's implicating a privacy interest? Because if it is, we don't, and I'll let David get his digs in on this in a second. If you say it's a privacy interest, we don't really, I don't know how well the Fourth Amendment protects against government searches of their own employees. We know that it has some implications for high schools and lockers, and maybe you can tell me if there's a specific category of law when the employer happens to be the government.
I don't think it really makes much of a difference because, again, the legal trigger is a reasonable expectation of privacy. And
you should have the employee's level of expectation of privacy as against your employer.
With actual notice, I have to believe that in all governmental uses of these kinds of systems, there is actual notice. I mean, for instance, when a Department of Defense employee logs onto the DOD network, the first screen that comes up says this is a regulated network that is subject to monitoring. If you go into the Pentagon or other sensitive agencies, the telephones actually have stickers on them that say, warning, this telephone
call is a conference call.
Is subject to monitoring. So I think in the governmental context, there is always going to be notice. And that, of course, defeats any reasonable expectation of privacy.
Yeah.
And were you being monitored? I would like to think you weren't in that case.
So to help focus the conversation, how much does this make you not sleep well at night, David? You've seen privacy in all sorts of guises. Again, most common these days is in the commercial context. Here's in the employment context, where I think we're all agreed that the legal doctrine makes it clear that there's no issue as yet. The employer, perhaps with disclosure, probably even without, if the instrumentalities are being owned by the employer, has every right to do whatever it pleases with them. How does that fit into something that would worry you?
Well, I do worry about it because, well, particularly where there's no notice. And I think this is becoming the issue with respect to these systems. I know that in a few states, legislation was at some point in the past introduced. I actually lost track of what happened to it. In the email context, that would have required an employer that had a policy of monitoring email to inform employees before they could actually conduct monitoring. So I think the notice requirement is something that is really key. So I have most of my concerns in the area of surreptitious monitoring. But even having said that, I think employees, the mindset of employee is not to make a distinction between, they're given a computer and they don't really make a distinction between work and personal business. You're given this resource, you send email to your friends, you send email to your family. I think there needs to be a lot more education within the workplace if the norm is going to be any kind of monitoring. If people need to understand that they need to compartment how they use the internet. And I think a lot of people get caught up in the lack of that distinction, that this is my computer, this is my email account, when in fact it isn't.
Now, we read an interesting story very close to home at Harvard, of the Harvard Divinity School dean, who found it hard to compartment what he was doing because he's living in a house, it's his home, the house is provided by Harvard, sort of like a company town kind of thing. The computer is a Harvard computer, but in his den, and then he engages in activities that are not strictly work-related, and if he were to read the network use policy that was provided in the readings, it's not clear he'd have notice of what might happen. On the other hand, he invited into his house Harvard ITS technology people either to help him back up something or fix something, and then had in plain view file names that one could not help but see while one copying them that might be suggestive of content, and like the good minions they are, the ITS people promptly ratted on them. Now, to me, that's notable, not just because it's so close to home, but because it illustrates a life that is one that, in a blurred networked environment, may be increasingly common, one where you don't have these boundaries between home and work, and that thinking about company property versus your property, particularly when you are connected between the two on a network that is neither of yours, but for access to the network might be provided thanks to your company.
Well, the technology really changes the equation also. I mean, the mindset that most people bring into a workplace is, if I rip a piece of paper off the pad that the office provided me with and take the pen they provided me with and write a letter to my wife and put it in an envelope and stick it in the outbox in the office, my employer is not going to open that letter. But you then translate that same activity onto the company email system, and suddenly, for some reason, the expectations change. So I think there's...
One way it changes is that there's no public component end-to-end between the sending of an email and the receiving of an email. It may not be one company in the middle, but it's a series of private companies, by and large. Whereas with the Postal Service, there is this sense of public instrumentality, strong statutes protecting the sanctity of the United States mail, at least once it reaches a mailbox.
But in my hypothetical, it hasn't. It's just sitting in a company outbox.
Yes.
So I think you really can't blame the employees in these situations where they supposedly misuse office computer resources, because the translation just doesn't really work. And we talk a lot about the law not keeping pace with the technology, but I think just public attitudes and education of what has changed with the advent of this technology is also really lagging behind. And I think more and more people are going to get caught up in those problems.
James, other thoughts?
We go up a lot against blocking and filtering. A lot of companies are putting in blocking and filtering. And our attitude, again, not to be big brother, we do not block or filter anything. The suggestion is the employee can go anywhere, anytime, do anything they want. Let's be an adult about this, or let's be mature about it. And if you're having a bad day and you just get off the phone with a customer from hell and you got to play some solitaire, go ahead. You want to go to ESPN and look at how the Patriots did over the weekend? Go ahead. Don't make a career out of it. We're not going to restrict where you can and cannot go. We're just going to keep an eye on the abuse. It's all about the abuse. It's not about the use.
I guess the question I would have is, why not just do it the old-fashioned way, which is look at the productivity of the employee and whatever the reason for the distraction, whether guys sitting there reading a book or surfing websites, why should that change in terms of the monitoring that the employee, that the employer is engaging in? Why not just look at, is this guy producing?
I don't have a good answer for that question, but I can tell you we've talked to CEOs that say, you know, that guy, he plays solitaire 6 hours a day. Do something about it. I don't know that NetSea is going to help your problem. I mean, you got a problem with an employee, that NetSea is or is not going to fix it. I mean, this is
not just uninstall solitaire, but it actually comes with the Windows.
Yes.
If he's doing well, and it also, it's interesting because it gets into a distinction. We've all gotten used to call may be monitored for quality. And that's where the actual relationship is a customer frontline, customer service person, customer relationship where the company says, before the complaint rolls in, I want to be able to listen in and make sure our customers are being treated right. You may distinguish that from people who are working in a product-based environment. Input comes in the form of questions or paperwork. Output comes out in the form of answers or paperwork, and that's what you judge by way of productivity. That may be a different category than when the output is the conversation, is the activity, such as it is. Yes?
And just like the information the law to use in court as evidence against an employee who's
giving
out
on the job? Yes.
Has it been
used?
No comment. Yes.
Well, right now, maybe we don't see sort of negative consequences, so we should consider sort of alternative times or situations that we might be good for that. I think the opposite also is that the sort of level of privacy that we expect today is also a very new phenomenon, that a certain level of privacy hasn't existed across, you know, the different sort of mediums of communication or across generations. I mean, it's a relatively new phenomenon because the Americans are entitled to an extremely high level of privacy. So the question becomes, we've sort of been focusing the question on, well, how can we protect, you know, privacy interests, but also given that, you know, employers and, you know, maybe, you know, criminals with email intentions on the internet will be able to look into our lives or law enforcement or what sort of, you know, limits on what they can do. And I think the question could be asked reverse, which is just, you know, what information, you know, presume that they're entitled to look at economic information, which is just overwhelming, you know, the history of being a member of the American society. Then it's like, what other do they get? Not,
yeah. Well, it's true that over time, how much privacy we can readily expect has changed. Indeed, there was an era in which most people had a telephone that was part of a party line. It was just a big series of extensions down your rural route number 4, and if Melba was on, Selma could be listening in somewhere down the road. You just wouldn't have any way of really knowing. In fact, you have to pick up the phone to tell Melba to get off so you can make your call already and she can listen in to you. But the way that our concerns collectively about privacy, and I don't know if you got from the readings a flavor of how these concerns have manifested differently in Europe, say, than they have in the United States, but the way they've manifested enough to find their way into law have occasionally been topically based. Data about X, Y, or Z is specifically protected. Indeed, first among equals in this very narrow set of laws that protect by topic is videotape rentals. I'm not sure if it's been extended to DVDs. The law may be actually written so specifically that it has to do with video cassettes. And Blockbuster Video is specifically, as a result of Bork confirmation hearing, is explicitly prohibited by federal law from releasing data about who has rented what from their video store to the public. So one is topically based things. Again, there's only a handful of those. The other could be mode-based data gathering. And I put it as mode-based, maybe telephone surveillance. There are all sorts of laws about when even private citizens may tap a phone line, when private citizens may listen in on electronic mail or other electronic communications.
Again, most of these exempted in the employer-employee relationship because the mail server and computers are owned by the employer. So you get into some specific things there, and indeed, some have speculated that part of what is protected most is that which is most accurate, and hence is Linda Tripp under indictment for having made a tape recording. Under Maryland law, you can't even make a tape recording of a conversation without the consent of the other person. Even though you could happily blab about it, you could take notes about it. If you happen to have a good enough memory, you could recite the entire conversation into a tape immediately after it transpired. But somehow, something that is so authentic as to be the conversation itself is proscribed. And I see food rolling into the room, somewhat ahead of schedule, but it makes up, it averages out from last week, in which it's not here exactly on time. Please, make yourselves, I hope it's for us, though. Is that right? I understand the food is for us, so please, make yourselves at home. This will limit, perhaps, the amount of time left to us in the class. But you see, then, different ways of trying to get at the protection of privacy. I just want to do another quick survey. I'm curious, how many people have been a summer associate at a law firm thus far? How many people would have to drastically change their habits at the firm if they were alerted that this software were available? How many people would not? Interesting. Very interesting, yes.
I'd like to make a comment. I trust that you're aware, you know, if you're using Internet Explorer, while you're surfing the net, there's like three records being made of what you're doing. You've got a history folder, you've got a temporary Internet folder, and you've got the cookies that are coming in. And one need not be a high-level techie to see where you were and what you were doing. I mean, if you're concerned about what you've done, don't think just cleaning out the history file is going to hide what you've done. And more importantly, on email, when you send an email, there's no privacy at all. It goes out there, and it's on servers at ISPs, and we're working on a case right now. We're looking at emails from a year ago where a woman was being stalked by email. There is no privacy.
Now, we did, there actually are sociologists in the world who study the way that people relate to computers versus how people relate to people. And there's one wonderful sociologist at Carnegie Mellon who wrote a book about this. And I think she was prompted by marveling at the way in which the officers who beat up Rodney King fessed up to it so readily over the little teletype computer that's in the cabin of their police cruisers. You go in and type little messages back and forth to headquarters, and they're perfectly logged. There was no question it was logged. They typed, boy, did we just do a Mondo beating. I mean, you know, they were just chatting about it as if it were a chat room. And it just seemed odd to her because obviously when questioned in person, they had a very different story to tell once in a formal environment, not even before realizing that perhaps they might get in trouble for this. And she actually ran a survey where she would interview people in person. She would interview them over the telephone, and she would interview them by teletype and try to generalize about whether people were more or less forthcoming depending on each of the media. And she found persistent patterns of far more forthcomingness over a teletyped medium. And again, this is after they had been disclosed that perhaps this might be recorded. The most she could do in her experience, in her experiments, to see what would affect how forthcoming people were, the most she could do to change it was like the blinking eye. She had a blinking tape recorder in the corner of the screen during some of the transcribed chats, and that made people clam up real fast. That gets a little bit at another question, which is when you talk about consent and about contracting, waiving rights, having things disclosed to you, it's weird because you can transform most people into the majority of students in this room quite readily. If you phrase the contract right, if you phrase it only once and have them click OK and it's done with, rather than the kind of constant reminder. And an environment in which the constant reminder becomes itself something you're used to. Reminder is, by the way, don't trust anything. Realize that anything you type could be, in fact, looked at. I think we either enter a denial of some kind, saying, yeah, but it won't be, or seek safety in the fact that most of what we might do is either sufficiently innocuous or only as bad as what the next person's doing, so why would we be singled out?
that privacy isn't necessarily on the forefront of our minds.
Well, there's, you know, there's also a body of research about the psychology of web surfing and this phenomenon that's called flow, where you just kind of go from link to link, and it's sort of a specialized way of relating to information. And I don't think when you're in the midst of that experience, you're thinking back, well, is this URL being logged by my ISP? It's just, you know, not in keeping with the experience of using the internet to constantly be pulling yourself back and saying, wait a minute, is this a place that I want to be on record going to?
Yes.
I don't think that's part of what you're talking about.
Yes. Now, this is a somewhat unusual week as cyber law courses would go. Most cyber law courses, if you did a privacy week, wouldn't do this. They would either delve into the FTC rules regarding consumer privacy and disclosure there. They keep focus on the commerce. Or they'd even just, you know, kind of catalog some of the laws we've only glancingly mentioned that protect pockets of privacy, be it by mode or by topic area or by geographic place. You have privacy in your house if you don't have otherwise, in a way that we haven't. My attempt here is to kind of take us off that beaten path, see in some sense a future that I'm fairly convinced is but a year or two away, in which there's far more ubiquitous data gathering, data use in multimedia, not just what you type or an email you might send, and how we might collectively think about it and think of responses to it. In other ways, too, this week will provide a building block for some of the later policy weeks we hit, because many of the solutions that have been arrived at to cure whatever particular ills have been identified are ones that have obvious ramifications for privacy. So it's not just about protecting privacy generally, if that's what you're into, but how to keep privacy in mind as you're fashioning these other solutions. It might be worth it even to think of software like that which we've just seen, or even the far more intrusive software that we had read about in Wired, to think about it along each of the ways that we define privacy. Does this software somehow speak to dignity? If you think of privacy as an intrusion upon your dignity, does this software fit in a way and cause a reaction in a way that it wouldn't if you're thinking about privacy as data collected about you and then shared with someone you didn't intend to have it? And in this case, we've been talking about the data just roughly staying within the company. So with that, I see we are out of time. We can address other questions as they come up, and there's a whole bunch of saran-wrapped food that we should uncover, and I hope you'll stick around, partake of, and thank our guests generally. I'm
Thank you. Thank you.